From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Jeremy Hobson's off today, and we wish you a happy new year. But will it be a happy week? Democrats take control of the House on Thursday. They'll vote on two bills that would put an end to the government shutdown. One would fund the Department of Homeland Security and offer the president some money for border fencing, if not his wall. The other would fund the rest of the federal agencies that have been mostly shuttered for the past 11 days now. In an interview with Fox News on New Year's Eve, President Trump said he was ready to cut a deal with Democrats if they funded a wall.
I'm ready to go. It's very important. A lot of people are looking to get their paycheck. And so I'm ready to go anytime they want. No, we are not giving up. We have to have border security. And the wall is a big part of border security, the biggest part.
Joining us for the latest, NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe. Ayesha, Happy New Year to you as well, although we're not so sure how happy things are going to be in Washington. Tell us first about the bill that would fund Homeland Security. This is at current levels, and it's only through February 8th?
Yeah, so this would just kind of give them a bit of breathing room because it's DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, where the real kind of beef is between Democrats and the president because he wants funding for some type of wall or barrier on the southern border. And so that would just be kind of stop the gap. And then you would have another selection of bills that would fund basically the rest of the agencies that have been shut down that aren't really controversial.
You know, these are House bills. The Democrats will control the House starting Thursday. Is the thinking that they will pass in the House, but then not in the Senate?
So, yes. So the thought is in the Senate, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he will not take up any bill for a vote unless President Trump supports it. And as we just heard, President Trump is saying without a wall, we will not support it. So it doesn't seem like what they're voting on in the House will go anywhere.
Speaking of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, where has he been during this? It's a government shutdown.
Well, it seems like what happened was you had the Senate pass a bill before the government shut down that didn't include funding for a wall. It seemed like they had an understanding that Trump would sign it. He decided he would not, and we ended up with a shutdown. And so basically the Senate said until the Democrats and the president reach an agreement, we're not going to vote on anything because it's not going to work unless they all get on the same page.
Well, and talk about that possibility of a negotiation because we all remember in December the president said he'd be proud to shut down the government for border security. This was in that sit down in the Oval Office with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And in that moment, he also said he wouldn't blame the Democrats for a shutdown. Now he's blaming the Democrats entirely for the shutdown. And yet he stayed in Washington, did not go to Mar-a-Lago, did not go to Florida for a break or for his, cherished New Year's Eve party. And did he not reach out to Democrats? Did Democrats not reach out to him? How does that normally work?
Well, it seems like the talks have not really been ongoing. Like there had been a stall in the talks. And really, Democrats are saying they're not going to give anything for a wall. And that appears right now to be unacceptable to the president. So there just hasn't been any give and take over these past couple of days.
And we have said this before, but you have people like Senator Lindsey Graham saying, why should Democrats give anything if they don't get something? I mean, there's an understanding in Congress that that's usually how it works. But, you know, the president is fulfilling his campaign promise. That's what he says. Can he get out of this without anything short of at least the $5 billion that he wants for the wall?
I think that he could probably get out of this without the $5 billion. The question is, can he get out of this without any funding for the wall, which, as you said, is a central promise to his campaign? So is he going to be able to offer something to Democrats, or will the Democrats feel pressure to give him some type of money for a barrier? I think that's the real question right now.
Well, and you've got the Smithsonian Museums set to close tomorrow. Across the country, hundreds of thousands of government employees and contractors will lose their first paycheck January 11th. We're getting news that places like Joshua Tree Campgrounds, the parks are open but unstaffed, and Joshua Tree has just closed its campgrounds because the toilets are near capacity. They've had volunteers trying to stay ahead of things there. They can't. So it would seem, you know, pressure's mounting for lawmakers.
You're going to start seeing the real effects of this shutdown. We've had holidays, and so things were kind of quiet. But you have the USDA, where the offices that offer loans to farmers, they were able to stay open a little while. They're going to have to close now. So if you're a farmer and you've been hurt by tariffs, you really need some money, you're not going to be able to get it. You have the IRS, where many people are on furlough. It's about to be tax filing season. Mm-hmm. So this is going to have some real implications.
That's NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe. Ayesha, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to Utah now, which just saw its first New Year's Eve with a new strictest-in-the-country drunk driving law. Last weekend, Utah's DUI blood alcohol limit was lowered from 0.08 to 0.05. Other states are considering the move, and the National Transportation Safety Board wants it nationwide, saying studies show people are noticeably impaired after just one glass of wine. That's around 0.04, which is the limit for commercial truck drivers. Supporters of Utah's new law say it will save lives, but our next guest says the data doesn't back that. Robert Gerke is a columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, yours is a hugely Mormon state, but many Mormons say this isn't about morality, it's about safety. You say what?
Well, I mean, Utah already has one of the lowest DUI rates in the country, largely, as you mentioned, because of our predominant Mormon population. There's not a lot of drinkers here. If you dig into the data, though, there's in this 0.05 to 0.08 range, there's really only about two accidents a year, fatal accidents a year. And so we're targeting a very small problem, frankly, with a very big punishment, which is, you know, these DUIs carry very severe penalties. You lose your license for 18 months, you pay large fines, your insurance premiums go way up. And we're doing this in pursuit of trying to save potentially one life a year. These accidents also frequently involve other issues. Two-thirds of the accidents involve either drugs or alcohol, excessive speed, or youth drivers who aren't supposed to be drinking at all anyway. And so it's a very small segment of the fatal accidents on our roads that they're targeting.
Well, you write about one, the only fatal accident in 2017 where a Utah driver's blood alcohol level was between 0.05 and 0.079. And it sounds horrific, you know, somebody who was driving and hit someone on a scooter and killed them. If in fact, though, you could have saved that one life, if that one person driving hadn't had one drink, isn't that worth it?
Well, I mean, I think we should also note that the driver on the scooter tested positive for methamphetamine. And so, as I mentioned, you know, most of these accidents do involve drugs of another kind, or they do involve drivers who are driving in excess of 20 miles an hour over the speed limit. There was an incident in 2014 where a driver was traveling 75 miles an hour in a 40-mile-an-hour zone, went off the road, flipped a car, drove into a house, and killed two passengers. And it's a tragic accident, but I don't think that we can say that the driver being 0.06 was the cause of that accident, because clearly there were other factors involved.
Well, first of all, we appreciate you speaking to us about this from home, where your dog is weighing in on this as well. But you point out that it could be nearly 1,000 Utahns arrested for DUIs next year because of this new law, and that's according to forecasts from the legislature's budget office. 1,000 people losing their licenses, possibly jobs, paying huge fines. But the police are saying that they're not going to be relying on the breathalyzer. They're going to be still looking for impairment. So,
right.
You know, there are people with a glass of wine, a 0.05 level, who will be driving impaired, at least according to a visual from the police. Shouldn't they be off the road?
Well, and it's interesting you mention that, because we did try to test this to see how many drinks it takes for an individual to get over 0.05. It's very, very difficult, not just for the person drinking the drinks to know when they're at 0.05, but it's very difficult for the law enforcement to be able to discern whether somebody's at 0.05 or not. Yes, impairment will be the standard. You have to be weaving or violating some other law in order for them to pull you over. But once you're stopped, you know, then it's a very subjective measurement of whether or not you are safe to be on the road and whether or not they do give you the breathalyzer. You know, and I also, frankly, get a little uneasy when when law enforcement says, trust us, we're only going to enforce this in these narrow circumstances. I mean, I'm a white male, and so I don't have necessarily a fear of the police or, you know, I haven't, but there is a potential there for this to be used as an excuse to stop people or to, you know, then proceed to the next step of giving them a breathalyzer and arresting them. And so it's a very subjective measurement is what I'm trying to say.
Well, and there are people who disagree. We want to mention a representative there, Norm Thurston from Provo. He believes that, you know, the current law sends the wrong message, which is it's okay to drink and drive as long as you're not buzzed. I mean, there are people who think, you know, if you wait till you're buzzed, which is raising the level, I mean, that's crazy. Impairment begins with the first drink. If you're drinking, don't drive. You say, well, then maybe you should have passed a law that was 0-0.
Right. My point there was, if they're going to make a statement that we don't want people to drink and drive, then make the law don't drink and drive. You know, saying some risk is okay, some risk is not, and then not attaching that to the actual data that we've seen on the roads it makes it an arbitrary figure that we're going to assign to this, and it comes with, again, very onerous penalties.
That's Robert Gerke, a columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, on Utah's new blood alcohol limit of 0.05%, the strictest in the country. Robert, thank you.
Great, thank you. Happy New Year.
Oh, you too. So what will we be eating in 2019? Will kale be so 2018? Will you be sipping cheese tea from Taiwan? We hear it's already hot in San Francisco. And what is up with mushrooms? Well, it's Kara Nielsen's job to spot trends. She's vice president of trends and marketing at CCD Helmsman, a culinary innovation firm in Emeryville, California. And Kara, you start with the Australian influence. I'm trying to think what that is. I don't think I can think of Australian cuisine. What is that?
Well, think about avocado toast and recognize that that item was very popular in Australia before it was popular here. Also think about overnight oats and porridge.
When you say overnight oats, is that soaking them overnight? What?
Right, which is already very popular on social media. You'll see all kinds of recipes for soaking oats plus seeds, different types of grains and nuts, fruits, dried fruits, and you soak them overnight and they're ready to go in the morning.
Well, you know, I can just hear someone saying, oh, please. I mean, that's why they make Quaker. You know, I can see people reacting to this idea of we have to have new trends in food. The New York Times did a piece too with what to expect in 2019, that this idea of healthier and more do-it-yourself is huge.
It definitely is. More and more people are really figuring out what they want to eat for themselves and what's going to work for them. So, for example, that could be one of our other trends, cheeses made from plants or very often from cashew nuts. And we see more and more plant-based cheeses and choices, whether it's a cream cheese or a fresh cheese or a pub dipping cheese or even a meltable mozzarella type cheese. Huh. We're going to see more choices like that next year.
Well, and the New York Times again points out that a plant-based main course is really hot. And for instance, in Los Angeles, someone on the city council there is proposing a law that would require a vegan protein entree would be available at movie theaters. And when you talk about diets, one of your colleagues or someone at least in this field, this is Hannah Spencer. She also tracks the food service industry for the company Mintel. Said the keto diet might be on its way out. Something called Pegan, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's that?
It's this cross of like paleo-vegan. And it's things like this, I have to say, that do cause a few eyes to roll. But so that's going to be focusing not on things like grains and highly processed sugars, which all kinds of people are deciding they're less interested in, and a bigger focus on really good, healthful fruits and vegetables. Cauliflower has become kind of the new kale. And we now are seeing cauliflower pizza crust all over the place.
Okay. And somebody just fainted somewhere. You know, no, don't do that to my pizza crust. But people are. What is going on with mushrooms? I'm hoping down the road to speak with Paul Stamets, who is a mycologist who's apparently super hot right now. His book, Mycelium Runnings, is subtitled How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. The Times picks it, too, as the it vegetable. You pick it. Why?
One of the things we're learning is that mushrooms have incredible nutrients that can really help us and really especially people who have a plant-based diet, but also mushrooms have both this combination of these fantastic nutrients as well as the umami taste, which makes food taste savory and delicious. We're starting to see mushroom powders that bring medicinal benefits to foods, whether it's a snack bar or a cereal. Some of the mushroom supplement companies are now working with food manufacturers to infuse those foods with a little mushroom magic. There's also mushrooms that are being grown under light so that they have high levels of vitamin D, which is something that many people are looking for. Many mainstream folks are trying to get more vitamin D in their diet. And so I think we're going to see both this nutrition from kind of medicinal mushrooms that help with mental focus, anti-stress, give us a little boost, as well as those vitamin D mushrooms, and then just flavorful umami-rich mushrooms in all kinds of moments of the day.
Yeah. Okay. So mushrooms are going to be hotter than they already are. You talk about fruit meat, fruits joining vegetables and being meat substitutes so you can grill and shred them. You've got people are using seafood in things like crackers, so more seafood. But tell us about cassava and cascara.
So those are two interesting ingredients that we're going to be seeing more of. So the cassava root is a tuber native to South America. It's also known as the yucca root. It's turned into tapioca, which we're very familiar with. So it's a very starchy root that in South American countries, especially Brazil, that root is turned into a fine starchy flour that is used as an alternative to wheat flour. And so some of the things that we're starting to see made from the cassava root include grain-free items like tortillas and Brazilian cheese rolls, which are a fabulous kind of cheese puff made, and they're very chewy because they're made with tapioca flour. But we're also seeing cassava being turned into like an alternative potato chip, just like a sweet potato chip or a potato chip. Now we're going to have cassava chips. And so that's one new international ingredient that is sort of turning up in our diet. And then cascara is the dried husks of the coffee cherry. So when coffee beans are picked, there's a fruit on the outside that is left to dry, and then we extract the seed, and that inside little seed is our coffee bean. But the husks on the outside also have great levels of antioxidants, a little bit of caffeine, and a very neat flavor. And so we're starting to see bottled beverages and beers and spirits even, and teas made from cascara in a resourceful way. And this is part of the bigger trend of avoiding food waste, of mission-based brands discovering an ingredient or a group of people that perhaps will benefit from those types of, you know, what used to be a byproduct of the coffee growing industry can now be a value-added ingredient that enables those coffee growers to benefit from all parts of that plant. And these beverages are also, you know, quite tasty and give you a little caffeine boost.
Speaking of beverages, just real quick, the Times and, you know, Fortune magazine, Forbes, a lot of people are looking at what's ahead because there's a financial interest in it. Do you agree with the thinking that young people who drive a lot of this are more interested in spirit-free cocktails? They don't want as much alcohol in their drinks.
Yes, that's very true. And this is a trend that I've been tracking since 2013. And it also came over from the UK. There was a big trend in kind of taking a break in January, something called dryuary, where people would have a dry month of January to make up for probably all the overindulging one does in December. But because there are such interesting and delicious drinks available in bars and in restaurants, there is definitely an interest in enjoying some of these in a way that you don't become impaired and you can continue to enjoy your cocktail without the kind of ill effects of too much alcohol.
Yeah. Fascinating. Couple last things. Eggs, which, you know, were out for a while. Now they're back in. And by the way, that might happen to everything on our list here. It might quickly go by the wayside, but they're back in. High protein breakfast. But they're going beyond breakfast?
They definitely are. And what and this really corresponds with the interest in protein as well as fewer carbohydrates. And this kind of fits back into your paleo trend, although not the vegan trend. So again, it gets very confusing. But the interest in eggs, a lot of it is hard-boiled eggs, different types of little egg bites. The Starbucks has done an amazing job with those sous vide egg bites that they're selling, which have, you know, no gluten, very few carbohydrates. There's a new brand called Peckish that is selling hard-boiled egg kits with a couple hard-boiled eggs and then some really interesting seasonings that you can put on your eggs. And those, I expect to see those in convenience and grocery stores next year. Again, really meeting that demand that is out there for a really healthy, high-protein snack.
It's such so interesting because there was a time when people didn't want to buy hard-boiled eggs from convenience stores, right? Because they didn't trust it. But now, as you say, it's new companies coming out with new approaches to that. Look, you say you work with innovative companies. So how do you do this? I mean, you know, speaking of eggs, is it chicken or egg? I mean, are you trying to drive people to these things because the companies are making them? Or are you genuinely seeing these trends and alerting companies to them?
It's trends that we're seeing. We are looking at places that are influenced both by trends in health as well as culinary arts. We look to see what chefs are doing, what's happening on the ground, some of the edgier things, and then we look for connections to what consumers and eaters are wanting. So we observe these things and then share the flavors, the benefits, the interesting types of formats that we're seeing with companies that are trying to innovate and create their own new products.
So it sounds like consumers are leading. Look, just as you look at the industry, we've talked about nine of the trends that you pick. What's one thing, like an overarching trend in the industry you also want to let us know about?
It's very much plant-based eating continues to be the overarching theme. And of the nine trends that we put out, there's three or four of them that fit into that plant-based eating. And it's really encouraging how folks are getting so excited about finding some of these new plants, vegetables, whether it's mushrooms, whether it's tomato pretending to be ahi tuna in a sushi roll. It's very exciting and hopefully also delicious.
Karen Nielsen, Vice President of Trends and Marketing at CCD Helmsman. They're a culinary innovation agency. The food trends for 2019. Kara, thanks so much.
Thank you and Happy New Year.
Oh, same to you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Just a few minutes into this new year, 12:33 a.m. Eastern Time this morning to be exact, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft flew by Ultima Thule, an object 4 billion miles from Earth, further away than any other object ever explored by humanity. Here's Alice Bowman, Mission Operations Manager, after New Horizons sent back a signal a few hours ago.
We have a healthy spacecraft. We've just accomplished the most distant flyby. We are ready for Ultima Thule science transmission at 200 UTC today. Science to help us understand the origins of our solar system.
That's it.
Yay. Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope magazine, has been watching all of this. He's at Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, where the New Horizons Mission Operations Center is. Kelly, sounds like quite a moment.
Boy, it sure was. And it was a little bit tinged with anticipation and concern, because not because the spacecraft might fail, but because they really didn't know exactly where in space this object was. It was only discovered 4 years ago, and very, very little is known about it.
Yeah, it's not a planet. It's in the Kuiper Belt. What is it, and what's the Kuiper Belt?
These are literally pieces of stuff that are left over from the formation of the solar system. They're about half again as far away as Neptune is from the sun. And this one is only about 20, 25 miles across. It is literally a Rosetta Stone that can teach us how the solar system came together.
Is it possible, are we reading that this might have been there at the beginning?
Exactly so. And, you know, what we're looking for is it's probably an icy object, like a comet that hasn't come close to the sun. It's been in the deep freeze way out there since the beginning. So it should have all of the chemicals on it that it formed with. And that's what's really key here.
So these people must be so excited, you know, with the New Horizons. It also flew past Pluto in 2015, sent back the sharpest images we've ever gotten of Pluto. Where else is it heading?
Well, it's heading out of the solar system, escaping the sun forever. This might be the last object that New Horizons gets to see. We've only seen the barest glimpse of it yet because the best images have yet to come down. But it looks a little bit like, in the fuzzy image that we see, a little like a bowling pin, or like two objects stuck together, a peanut, if you will. And that tells us something about its dynamical history. But until we get the best images, which will start tomorrow, we'll just be guessing.
Well, Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope Magazine, thank you so much for being right on the story for us today. And congratulations to scientists everywhere.
See you, Robin. Take care.
See you. And by the way, speaking of which, this music, it's called New Horizons. It was released today by Brian May. You know, he's the lead guitarist for Queen, but he's also an astrophysicist. He was a contributing scientist to New Horizons. Go to his Twitter feed. He's been following all of this. This is the song he wrote for this. Quite a day. The Refugee Act was signed into law by President Jimmy Carter in 1980, created to help victims of conflicts. In the last fiscal year, the U.S. admitted 22,491 refugees from more than 60 countries, one of the lowest amounts on record. And most of those admitted came from the Middle East and Africa. For instance, about 3 years ago, when the Democratic Republic of Congo in Central Africa was plunged in a two-decade-long civil war, Francois Elise and Iluta Shabani and their families sought refugee status in Texas. They're now both students at the Margaret Long Wisdom High School in Houston, and we wanted to see how they're faring. Hint, better than they might be because of a soccer field and a great nonprofit. They are at KUHF in Houston. Iluta, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Francois, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and do I understand Francois, born in Congo, now 18, and Iluta, born in a refugee camp?
Yeah, Tanzania refugee camp.
And you're now 17. Both affected by the war in Congo. And both have come across somebody named Charles Rotrammel, who coaches you both. Charles, are you there?
I am.
Talk first, Charles, about Revision, which is your nonprofit. What does your group do?
So Revision is a program that works with disconnected youth. So we're always trying to build kinship with young people who might not experience that otherwise, which is what draws us into the juvenile justice system. It draws us into the foster care system, and it drew us to create a soccer field.
And it eventually drew you into the huge refugee community in Houston. And to Francois and Iluta. Francois, start with you. Iluta, you can chime in. What does a soccer field mean to you?
Soccer field is like my home.
It's even more than a home to me, yeah.
Why? Explain why. Is that Francois?
Yes, ma'am.
Explain why.
For me, soccer itself is a really big passion to me. Since I started playing when I was five, I was pushed towards something really important, and that was soccer.
Well, and Iluta, I can't imagine, when you came to this country, again, born in a refugee camp in Tanzania, can you explain how strange this country must have felt to you? You said the soccer field looked like home to you, but compared to what? Like, what are some of the things that were so strange to you?
We didn't used to see buildings like that.
Yeah.
Every time, till you go to town, maybe. That wasn't familiar. Sometimes you have to walk from far away. We didn't have no bass. You might see a car, but to have a car over there, you have to be really, really rich. You have to have a lot of money.
Yeah. So here you're seeing cars and buses and huge buildings. And then in the middle of all of this, a soccer field. So, Charles, it sounds as if this became a magnet for young people like Francois and Iluta.
Right. So we opened on Sunday after church, and we said, any high school age soccer player, just come and play pickup games on the field. And a lot of young men came who are from the same background that Eluta and Francois are from.
And you also, I'm sure, have other children of immigrants, probably Latinos, Houston.
Absolutely.
What's this mix like?
It's just created this magical chemistry because they don't all come from the same country. They didn't all grow up together. They don't all even all speak the same languages. But we have this bond that I've never experienced before.
Eluta, I understand that, again, you were born in a refugee camp. Your mom's in a wheelchair. Disabled during the civil war in Congo. How are you helping out at home?
I'll be helping her do a lot of stuff when I'm home. Sometimes I help her to cook, clean the house, and do some other stuff.
Translate?
Translate, yeah, English. Sometimes when she go to some offices, because she don't speak English, I help her translate.
I'm imagining there's been a lot of stress for you. Living
sometimes,
in a refugee, yeah, living in a refugee camp, you know, striking out in the U.S. as refugees. What do you feel like when you're out on the soccer field? Does it feel like a different you?
True, you feel like different me because anytime, even when you're walking, you might be going to the store, even if you see a lot of things looking like a boy, I'm going to just start kicking it. I'm going to start imagining like I'm in the soccer field.
Anything that looks like a ball.
We're always trying to play like something that looks with the ball.
Always trying to score with like a box in the street.
Yes, yeah. True.
But in your native countries, Francois, didn't you use things like wadded up tape and stuff for soccer balls?
Yes, ma'am.
So this comes natural to you. Francois, I want to ask you something, too, that we're hearing, that when you're on the soccer field, some of the other teams can be cruel.
Yes.
Why? What happens?
To be honest, as soon as we step in the park of the field, every person on that park, they start looking at us. I don't know what's wrong with that, but we don't pay attention on them. We keep moving to what we came there to do.
Well, Charles, I understand that one match got particularly ugly. I mean, people are yelling not just racial epithets, but in a couple of occasions you've had players and parents talking, you know, yelling things about these kids being refugees.
Yes, that unfortunately happens quite a bit. And there was a particular game, it was a final of a tournament, where the players and the parents were just being really very racist in what they were saying. It was very emotional for all of us because it's hard to know what to do in that situation.
What do you tell your kids?
Well, honestly, Robin, that day, I was very emotional at the end of that game. And I brought the kids over into a circle. We typically meet in a circle after the game. And I just said, this should never happen, but it does. This is America, and there is racism. And that doesn't mean that it's right. It's not right. But unfortunately, this is the reality that we all live in.
Well, on the other hand, Francois and Eluta, I understand you've also seen some of the good that can happen in this country. Dick's Sporting Goods awarded money to keep the soccer team afloat for a few years because I guess Revision was struggling.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. What did you think when that happened? Like, I think it was $120,000.
That was a great donation to us because at that time, like mostly every player didn't know what to do because some of us were already affected with the Harvey and stuff.
Affected by Hurricane Harvey, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So they didn't know what to do. All they could think of is come together, be around each other and giving hope.
Charles, what do you do with that money?
We've been able to get a van that gets us to and from games and practices. It's allowed us to go out of town, so we've taken some trips to San Antonio and actually to Missouri to play soccer games and have college coaches take a look at our players. It actually allowed us to get six of our players onto a college team in the fall. And it really it continues to allow us to feed the kids, which is really, really important. Food insecurity is a huge issue for a lot of our players. And so every time that we're together for practices or games, we're able to feed them.
Yeah. We'll talk about the college part. Eluta, you're a year younger, but Francois, you know, you're applying for college next year. Soccer, I hear what it's doing for you. It reminds you of home. It makes you feel great about yourself, you know, athletic and out there, all good. But is this also something that's you think is a pathway to your future?
Yes, it is. It's helping me discover what I want to do in college and stuff.
So it's a pathway to college. Also, Iluda, I understand it's a pathway out of neighborhoods that may not be safe. You know a thing or two about things that aren't safe, having lived in a refugee camp. But tell me about that part of it.
My neighborhood, some shooting be happening.
Yeah.
It was this night. We was sleeping and I started hearing gunshot outside. And I was a little bit scared because he might come through the window.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm good because I don't be there all the time. Right. I'll be on the soccer field every time because I spend a lot of my time in school and soccer.
Charles, this is the goal, correct? To keep people on a different path.
Absolutely. The reason that we wanted to start this team, was because, A, we saw the potential, the talent that they had, and B, you know, the pressures of the neighborhood were starting to get to some of our players. There's a lot of gangs in the area, and some of those gangs were starting to put pressure on some of the players to join them or hang out with them, smoke weed. And we just didn't want to see that trajectory happen because these kids can make it on the soccer field.
Well, meantime, you guys, I hear, are good. Francois, you're the team captain. Are you guys good?
Yes, ma'am, we are.
Tell me, what have you won?
In Texas, we ranked like third.
Third place.
What?
We ranked in third place in Texas.
What?
Yeah.
Whoa. So yeah. Third in the state. You should be proud.
Yes, we are.
We was proud.
Yeah. Well, we wish you the best of luck. And thank you so much for talking to us.
No problem.
Thank you.
Francois Elise, Iluta Shabani, refugees from Africa living in Houston, and their soccer coach Charles Rotramel from the nonprofit Revision. The whole soccer team will play in the South Texas State Cup competition beginning in March, running through the end of May. Best of luck. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says he's ready to meet President Trump again to talk about denuclearization, but he also warned Washington not to test North Korea's patience with sanctions and pressure. Kim delivered that message in his televised New Year's speech. Last year's speech kicked off that unprecedented diplomacy, which included the North's participation in the Winter Olympics hosted by South Korea, and eventually Kim's historic summit with President Trump in June. Jean Lee is director of the Korea program at the Wilson Center. Jean, welcome back. We're wishing you a happy year, but wondering what kind of year you see for U.S.-North Korean relations. You were watching today. What jumped out in Kim's speech?
Yeah, you know, these New Year's Day speeches by the North Korean leader are so crucial. I have spent the last, I don't know, how many years waking up early to make sure to watch these because they set the tone not only for North Korea's domestic priorities, but also they send a message to the outside world. And we were really watching this closely because it's been weeks of stalled diplomacy between the United States and North Korea. Lots of questions about where the momentum from that Singapore summit last June, where it was headed. And so this really set the tone, and I think it was reassuring for Washington and Seoul to hear Kim Jong-un tell his people and really tell the world that he's still committed to this process. So I think that it's going to be dramatic. It always is with North Korea, but at least we know that he is sticking to some of those principles and goals that he laid out in 2017 and that he hasn't veered off that track.
But how do you know to believe him? And let's just remind ourselves that, you know, these are two men that hated each other. President Trump made fun of Kim, calling him Rocket Man at the UN in 2017. Kim said disparaging things about Trump. But then in 2018, Trump said he fell in love with Kim, talked about the beautiful letters that Kim wrote to him. But his administration has canceled meetings with high-level North Korean officials. So what do we know about what he has done about denuclearization, if anything?
It's important to be cautiously optimistic. I always like to use that phrase because I think it's fine and it's absolutely necessary to be somewhat skeptical because North Korea has gone back on its word many, many times in the past. The United States has as well. And so, this is a little bit of a tug of war. We have been engaged in a game of chicken with the North Koreans. And so we're going to see both sides reluctant to be the first one to make that initial first step toward denuclearization. And so I do think we have to be cautious, but we should also be grateful for the fact that we have some room to work with here and that he hasn't gone back to the rhetoric that we saw, obviously, in 2000. 17. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are a couple cautionary notes. He is referring again to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula as the goal, and that's a very different definition than the denuclearization of North Korea. Mm-hmm. And so that is always a reference to requiring that the United States withdraw its nuclear umbrella over South Korea. And so this might mm-hmm. seem like insider language, but that's always the kind of language that we look for mm-hmm. When we look at this. He did, though, I have to say, give him credit, he did say that he would not make nuclear weapons. Again, as you point out, how do we believe him? I think we need to be skeptical, but also try to hold him to his word.
And what sense do you get that the Trump administration, which is missing some key members right now, but that the Trump administration might consider, reducing sanctions, or Congress might?
These sanctions is obviously the big concern for North Korea. They cannot move forward economically unless some of these international and U.S. sanctions are lifted. And so we will see very pointed language from North Korea regarding those sanctions. The United States has said that they need to see much more progress on denuclearization. I think that the United States will be looking for concrete measures, very, very concrete shows of commitment to that process before any sanctions are lifted.
Well, so he spoke for a long time. Was there anything else that jumped out? I mean, is he reading a new book? Is there anything else that jumped out that he might have said?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the books, because just the fact that he gave this televised broadcast in his library is something that I took note of. You know, he was wearing a suit. And also, I should just point out that this is very reminiscent of his grandfather, the eternal president of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, who gave this type of New Year's address, but over the radio. Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, who ruled for 17 years until 2011, never gave a broadcast. The North Koreans never saw him give the New Year's Day address at a podium or in a library, even over the radio. It was always published in the newspaper. So very different style that Kim Jong-un is projecting. And that's really notable. I mean, this is propaganda, but the kind of message that he's trying to send his people, that he's authoritative, but that he is comfortable in his skin, and also to the outside world, he's trying to project himself as somewhat of a normal leader.
I have books.
I have books. I would love to take a close look at what books are on his shelves. I can tell you that he does have the collected works of his grandfather, Kim Il-sung. Mm. But this is something that's notable. It's meant to send a message, not only, again, to his people, but also to us.
Jean Lee, director of the Korea program at the Wilson Center. Jean, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. We here wish you a happy new year. Fingers crossed on some of these headlines. Please join us again here and now.